So this is the third day of the seven-day retreat on fettering the natural mind. And we have been spending these last days calming the mind through practices of mindfulness and concentration. We have been opening the mind through practices relating to space, beginning to utilize the external space, the so-called external space around us, and in sky gazing, as well as beginning to notice the space that is within our own minds. We have also received instructions on how to examine our minds. And as we learned in the teachings prior, mind is king. Body and speech, in terms of their actions, take their commands from their mind. And so therefore, any transformation in the body or in our capacity to speak can only occur when there's a transformation in the mind. As well as, since the mind is the seat of all our emotions, is the seat of our happiness and our unhappiness, is the seat of our peace of mind or non-peace of mind, conflict, agitation, and all the mind states of dissatisfaction, etc., all are found in the mind. So it is the mind that we need to look. And obviously the practices of calming, the practices of mindfulness, the practices of introducing the spaciousness of mind are all having to do with the transformation of this mind and using it in a different way that we have not been taught up to now. But also we must examine. And that is what we did yesterday, and that is what we will continue to do. Because unfortunately, we have not examined the very core beliefs that we live by, such as I have a mind and it's a solid real thing. Such as I am a self, I am an ego, I am a me, I'm an I. Such as thoughts are real, emotions are real, issues are real. These are all types of activities that we have just gone along with and never stopped to examine. We've never looked deeply into the physicalness of things, whether they're permanent or impermanent, whether they're solid or made of parts. We've never really tried to understand why do things happen the way they do? Why is somebody the way they are? So again, while practices of mindfulness and concentration, etc., can be very beneficial in a certain way, they will not liberate us. That is their problem. We can be much more mindful in life. We can have a little more open, spacious mind. But if we are still running our life to the commands of an imperious self, if we are still lost in the world of our own mental fabrications and think they're real, if we cannot differentiate between a thing as it really is and the thing that, and the way thing as we think or perceive it is, we will always be lost in delusion. It's, you know, why is that a bad thing? Because it is suffering. It is needless suffering. And it, even when it is not suffering, it is a state of what might be called alienation or separation or disconnection. So even when we may not be suffering in a grosser way, things may be going well, there always is that sense that there's an I separate from life. We always feel alone in a certain way, even when involved in things or or with others. And even when things are going well, there's always somewhere back in the mind something going on that gnaws away at us. And even no matter how many goals and objectives we achieve, the mind is not satisfied and always looking for others very quickly. It is unending. So there are many important reasons why we need to practice calming the mind and concentrating the mind. But the most important thing is that we understand deeply. That is wisdom. Looking deeply promotes wisdom, and it is only wisdom that will liberate us. So that is why during our time up here, we always, both in the first days of retreat and in every meditation session, spend some time calming and concentrating the mind. But the bigger thing is to really understand, to examine, what is my mind? Do I have a mind? I mean, we all talk that way, don't we? But is there really such a thing, an entity, called a mind? What is myself? Is there an I, a me? I mean, we talk this way linguistically, but does it really exist? Right? What is a thought? We have endlessly thoughts, but do we ever take it out and examine it? What is a thought? What actually is it as an experience? And where do they come from and where do they go? What creates thoughts? Is there a thinker? So these are very simple questions, actually. And they're so obvious, it's amazing that we've spent as many years as we have never turning our this capacity of our mind for insight and looking. We're always rummaging out here in the outer world. We use our analytical capacities to always think about things, our life and other people, and fixing this and analyzing this and assessing this and evaluating this, and endlessly. And it's endless. And at the end of the day, it does not produce happiness, calmness, open-heartedness. So these kinds of deep questions, which are so obvious, because it is things like a belief in a mind, belief in a separate self, a belief in the reality and the solidity of our thoughts and our feelings and our issues and our past and our future. These are the things that endlessly preoccupy us and prevent us from, as Thich Nhat Hanh would say, dwelling happily in the present moment. So hopefully we will be using these days up here on retreat to not only get away from everything, but to look deeply. And it's so easy, because what are we looking deeply into? Our own minds. We don't have to go far. I mean, it's that simple. We just got to turn around and look. Rather than following the thought, where do they come from? Rather than endlessly hearing the opinions and the spin that the self is putting on everything you do, to turn around and go, who's saying that? What is that? What is that voice in my head? What is that? Okay, so this is, when you're eating your food, I'm really enjoying this, or I'm really hating this, or what is it? What is this I that likes and dislikes? I'm really having a great time here. What a wonderful retreat. I'm having a terrible time here. I hate it. I can't wait till it be over. What is it that's saying that? We hear a voice, we hear thoughts, but is it really something? We think it is. We think it's me. But how could it be me, because I also hear it? Maybe there's two me's, the one who speaks and the one who hears. But who's the one who knows that there's one speaking and one hearing? Maybe there are three me's. Please look deeply into this. So today we will, for the time, leave our other text. And I am now reading from Treasures from Juniper Ridge. There's a nice photograph up front of I guess the place in Tibet where that is called Juniper Ridge. These called the profound treasure instructions of Padmasambhava to the Dakini Yeshe Tsogyal. As I said to you on the first day, Padmasambhava, like Bodhidharma, who brought these profound teachings looking directly at the mind to China, where they became known as Chan. Padmasambhava brought them around the same time to Tibet. It is said that Bodhidharma was from South India, and it is said that Padmasambhava was from Udayana, which was someplace in kind of northwest India, Afghanistan, Pakistan, in that area. And these were teachings that he gave when Padmasambhava came to Tibet. His foremost disciple was a woman by the name of Yeshe Sogyal. And she was a great practitioner and is really noted in Tibet for really not only receiving the teachings, but writing them down for future years. So, but she was his consort. They practiced together. So this is what I'm reading, is something called the Pointing Out Instructions to the Old Lady. And it begins, when the Nirmankaya in Buddhism, it is in the teachings, there are basically these three bodies of the Buddha. There is his Dharma body, which is his body of emptiness. There is his Sambhogakaya, his body of clarity and luminosity. And his Nirmanakaya, which is sort of his, it's kind of the way we see him. it's the body of a Buddha that miraculously manifests all the teachings of wisdom. That's what we see. The Sambhogakaya body and the Dharmakaya body really pertains to the mind of the Buddha. So once, when the Nirmanakaya master Padmasambhava was invited by King Tritsundetsen. King Tritsundetsen was the king at that time in Tibet, who actually historically did invite Padmasambhava to Tibet. Buddhism had been established in Tibet for a while, but was having problems. Prior to Buddhism coming to Tibet, Tibet had been what we might call today a shamanic culture. In shamanic culture, you know, lots of gods, and demons, and all kinds of spirits. And yeah, supposedly these shamanic forces were not happy that Buddhism had come to. And it is said that there was this great Buddhist teacher from India, Sangharakshita, and he was building the first monastery temple in Tibet called Samye. Samye is still there today. And anyhow, he was having little problems because by day they'd build it up. And then they come out in the morning, it was all torn down. Those evil shamanic ancient spirits of Tibet were not happy with what he was up to. So anyhow, the king thought, gee, we need a powerful kind of master. We just don't need a Buddhist master of philosophy and sutras and teachings. You know, we know somebody's got some power. Somebody looks like that, you know. Not somebody who looks like the guy on top. Maybe somebody who can shape these demonic forces right up. Well, so they heard about there was this great Buddhist master, Padmasambhava, and the king sent offerings, sent messengers out, and offered gold to him, and invited him to come to Tibet, where he did come, and he did subdue those malevolent forces all over there. He bound them to the Dharma. And sometimes you will see pictures in Tibetan Buddhism of these fairly demonic protector spirits. These are a lot of these, that's what these guys were. In the old days, they worked for the other guys. But Padmasambhava bound them with his great power, and now they serve the Dharma and protect it. Anyhow, So Pema Zambhava was invited by the king, and at that point, the Pema Zambhava was reciting at Samye. At the same time, residing there, was the virtuous lady of Tung, a woman of extraordinary devotion. So this is a laywoman, a woman of extraordinary devotion, and in truth, most lay Buddhists in Asia, and let's just say Tibet, they have a wonderful devotional quality. They may not know all the sutras, they may not know these teachings about the mind, but they have a great heartfelt devotion to the Dharma, to teachers, a great respect for it. It is the center of their lives. They have great hearts. But most of them, again, they do very simple practices, mantra practice, they do a lot of devotional practices even to this day. It's very common to see lay people, especially older ones, really spending all their days doing circumambulations and doing their mantras and telling their beads and spinning their prayer wheels and just doing like that. Many of them, when they get old, they move into monasteries or nunneries and they just live there. And they kind of help out, they putter around, and you see them, they're just going around, they're sort of preparing for their death, but also grateful that their days of work are over, and caretaking their families are over, and they can just devote themselves to practice. But again, most of them do not practice the deeper meditation teachings. So every day this lady of Tung, she was obviously of some kind of higher class, would send her attendant, the lady of Margung, her name was Rinchen So, to offer a morning meal of curd, that's the yogurt, with slices of grapes. So every day she would send her attendant to offer breakfast to Padmasambhava. Later, when Padmasambhava was on his way to Samye Chimpu, Isaac, I was in Chimpu. Chimpu is a day's walk from Samye, and it is a very sacred mountain area, and it is filled with retreatants, living in caves and little huts. It's really quite a wonderful place. And it is where, actually, Padmasambhava, after he had kind of established Buddhism in Tibet, he retired there with 25 disciples who he taught very intimately, really taught the deep teachings of Dharma, and is really from these 25 disciples that Buddhism really spread, and especially the meditative insight teachings spread throughout Tibet. So later, when he was on his way to Samye, leaving Chimpu, just as he was passing through the gate, the lady of Tung bowed down. So this is the old lady herself. She bowed down on the road and she circumambulated him. That's an ancient kind of way of showing respect. She went round and round. And she joined her palms before him and said, "Please, great master, you are about to leave, and this old lady is about to die." First of all, since I was born as a girl, I am of inferior birth. Please, women, do not get upset about that, and men, don't gloat. Actually, Tibet, as we can see, was a very egalitarian society, but it was considered, and also in India too, and again, it didn't mean that there weren't patriarchal stuff as well, but there was a sense, because of the social norms, men were free to leave home. You know, they could go wander about, but women were very circumscribed. You know, they had their roles very circumscribed. They just didn't chuck them and take off. So from the point of view of that, it was an inferior birth. Not like, and you'll see, not anything that they're inferior. So please don't take umbrage. And first of all, I was born a girl, I'm of inferior birth. And having been distracted by activities, which of course meant, she had lots of household activities and all this, I forgot the Dharma. Second, being of lesser intelligence, my wits are feeble. Third, I feel obscured due to my advanced age and my mind is unclear. All right, So for all of you who kind of feel that you've spent your life distracted by activities, always forgetting the Dharma, I think I'm really somebody of lesser intelligence. Actually, my wits are fairly feeble. And I'm getting old, and my mind is getting foggier and foggier. If there's anybody here, if that kind of meets your own criteria, please pay attention. This is for you. Okay. And she says, please, great master, bestow upon this old woman an instruction that requires little hardship, that is simple to grasp, easy to apply, and very effective. Please give an instruction for an old woman who would die soon. So it's quite poignant, right? And this is why I want to share this teaching with you, because, the recipient of this teaching is not a great yogi, not a great master of all the meditation practices, but a simple old woman devoted to the Dharma, but probably has never read a sutra, never read a teaching, doesn't really meditate, getting old, mind is foggy, doesn't have much energy, can't go off on retreat and stuff like that. So she's saying, can you give me a teaching for me? Easy to understand, and that I can apply. So let me just get a little tea so we can carry on here. And so I'm getting old and feeble myself. Again, I think her last line, please give an instruction for an old woman who will die soon, is also very poignant for both her and for him, right? She's old and she knows she will die soon. Her life is coming to an end. And obviously, she is feeling some regret. That during the course of her life she had not had time to practice. And she obviously still feels burdened by her obscurations. But she knows her time now is short. Right. And obviously she wants an instruction because she wants to really put it into practice. Right. She doesn't have much time. And that's important. Well, many of us practice as if we have lots of time, don't we? I guess when you're an old woman, quite weak and feeble, you can feel that your life energy is leaving you. We who don't feel that may think that death is far away, but we know that's not true. Even as we recite in the morning the five remembrances, the fire of impermanence is always raging. As I said earlier, there were at least five or six people, interestingly enough, all very much wanting to come to this retreat, all counting on coming to this retreat, all thinking they were coming to retreat, all had to bow out in the last week or two, most of them because of sickness. A couple because somebody close to them was dying and they wanted to be with them. So again, we think we will go on forever. And we think everything will continue and we will go to retreat after retreat. But we don't know if that's true. We don't even know if we'll make it through this one. Please give an instruction to an old woman who will die soon. Let me just say another thing. It is important when listening to Dharma teachings, especially in a group. Oftentimes we feel we're just getting, let's say there are 100 people, we feel like we're getting, one one-hundredth. Even in a small group like this, we may think we're just getting 1/25. We listen like that. Please listen like the teaching is just being directed to you. Take in 100%. So, Padmasambhava says, "O lady, who are you?" The old woman responded, "I am the one who's been sending a bowl of curd with a lowly maid." The master joyfully said, "You're surely one who has greater devotion than Tritsindetsan." Tritsindetsan is the king. He was actually very devoted. Then he instructed the old lady and her attendant, so he instructed them both, with these words, "Old woman, take the cross-legged position and keep your body upright. For a short while, simply remain with total relaxed attention." So why don't we all do that? With our body upright, let us for a short while simply remain with totally relaxed attention. Again, relaxed attention is something we've begun to cultivate in this retreat. The mind is relaxed, but it's very present. It's alert. It's wakeful. We're not trying to control anything. We're just cultivating wakefulness. The master then pointed his finger to the old lady's heart. This is very important. He pointed his finger right at her heart. Right at her. So she knew, and he knew, where this teaching was being directed. So he pointed his finger to her heart, and he gave this instruction. "Old woman, listen to me. If you are asked what the difference is between the mind of the truly perfected Buddha and the mind of sentient beings of the three realms, that's people like us, it is nothing other than the difference between realizing and not realizing the nature of mind." Somebody who understands the nature of their mind, the nature of reality, is a Buddha, is enlightened. Somebody who does not understand the nature of their mind is a deluded sentient being. That is the only difference. So this is very profound, because up to now, this old lady, like most devotional, think the Buddha is what? The Buddha. This elevated celestial being. Profound enlightenment. Appears only once in a world cycle. Right? And I'm just this feeble, old, ignorant, old, deluded old lady. Right? like the gulf between us is gigantic and unsurmountable. Maybe in a thousand kalpas, thousands of rebirths, I can somehow, eventually even get a glimpse. That's what most lay Buddhists would believe. So Padmasambhava, right to this old lady, what does he say? There is no difference between the mind of a sentient being and a mind of a Buddha, other than one understands the nature of their mind and one doesn't. Very profound what he says to her. Please listen carefully. He's talking to you. When you understand the nature of your mind, what is your mind? That which is listening right this moment. This is your mind. It is not something far away. It is not something. This very capacity that you have right now to hear and to know, this is your mind. When you know it in its very nature and you're clear about it, you are seeing now with the eyes of a Buddha. If you don't, you see with the eyes of a deluded being. So he said, since sentient beings fail to realize this nature, the nature of their mind, delusion occurs, and from this delusion, this ignorance of the way things really are, all the myriad types of sufferings come to pass. Thus beings roam around in samsara. Samsara is the world of, that's what we do, right? We roam about. We're just roaming about in samsara. We go from one, as Anne said, we go from one event to another. Right, just one event to another, some we like, some we don't like, some we hold on to, some we get attached to, some we work on letting go of, some we avoid, some we're happy with, some we're unhappy with, right? Endlessly we run around attending events. From the moment we wake up in the morning, and not only are we attending events outside, we're always having internal events, right, that we're also very involved in. All kinds of emotional dramas and melodramas, right? All this roaming about. Right? At the end of the day, we're exhausted, right? Creep into bed exhausted. All the roaming about I've been doing today. All this roaming about, he says, comes because we do not understand the nature of our mind, and therefore we are deluded, and from this delusion, all of everything unfolds. Thus beings roam through samsara. The basic material of Buddhahood is in them, but they fail to recognize it. And then he says to her, first of all, the basic material of Buddhahood is in you. In particular, it is in the human being to obtain the freedoms and the riches. What this is means, the freedom and the riches here is a particular Buddhist understanding of what they call the perfect human birth, which doesn't only mean, life of itself, just having a human birth, but it's when one has a human birth, that gives one the freedom and the opportunity and the leisure to not only have a body and a life that gives us the capability of doing something with. We are not burdened by overwhelming disease or poverty or living in a place of such suffering or affliction or difficulty that all life is an endless struggle. But if we are free of that, to one degree or another, as well as we have encountered teachers and teachings, the Dharma is still alive, so the path to freedom and liberation is still available to us and still being practiced, and we have the leisure and the time to practice it. All those kinds of circumstances are like what he says, you got the right material. Moreover, it is not such a basic material for Buddhahood. It is not such that the basic material for Buddhahood is abundant in men and deficient in women. What? Thus, even though you have taken rebirth as a woman, You are not prevented from attaining Buddhahood. So this is important. So when he says woman, he doesn't just simply mean physical woman. He's talking about her social position, right? So even though you have a social position that puts you in this constrained way, this in no way, in any way, intrinsically limits your capacity to become a Buddha, right? So this is important because many of us, because of social conditioning about who we are or who we're not, you know, all these kinds of issues, we think we are limited in our capacity for liberation. So please understand, he's saying, no matter whatever social status, social conditioning, personal conditioning, whether you had grew up in a loving family or a hateful family, whether this happened to you or that happened to you, you know, race, gender, class, the whole deal, sexuality, you know, all the things that seemingly divide us. He's saying none of that has to do with this. This is about the essential nature of your mind, and everyone has the same capacity. And especially if you have the right conditions, the freedoms and riches that were talked about, then you have all the conditions you need for achieving it. And then he goes on to say, the 84,000 Dharma doors, I don't know if you knew there were so many. Dharma doors are all the doors of how one can enter the Dharma. There's not just one door, there's 84,000. Again, because Buddhism is a teaching of upaya, of skillful means. Many, 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 many different. The way we have learned to use our breath, that's a Dharma door. The way we recognize space, that's a Dharma door. The way we learn to watch our thoughts and our mind, that's a Dharma door. These are all Dharma doors, lots of different practices, compassion, you know, endless practices, you know, meditative practices, visualization practices, mantra practices, devotional practices, you know, all kinds of practices. The 84,000 Dharma doors have been taught in order to recognize and realize the wisdom mind of the Buddhas. But this understanding is contained in a master's three words of instruction. Thus, even though you may be of inferior intelligence and feeble wits, you are not disadvantaged. Okay. Now, the meaning of the Dharma, the meaning of the Buddha mind, and the meaning of the Master's three words of instructions is this. By purifying externally perceived objects, your perceptions are freed in themselves. By purifying the perceiving mind within, your non-clinging awareness is freed by itself, as the lucid wakefulness between is delightful, you recognize your own nature. And then he will explain this, but so the three words of instruction: purify externally perceived objects, and your perceptions are freed in themselves. Yesterday we talked about what? There is the perceived objects, and then there is all the thoughts and the projections that we have about them. We ordinarily think they are the same, but we have learned they are not the same. When we can see the object just as it is, free of any identifying labels, interpretations, projections, right? At that moment, we have freed. We have freed this flower just to be itself. when I have freed these flowers from any ideas about flowers, any labels or names about flowers, I have freed this flower to be itself. And I can see it in its purified nature. If I do not do that, I am doing what? I am seeing the flower through my own mind's projections. I'm not seeing the flower, am I? Now, this is easy. But we do this with everybody. We don't see each other. We have ideas and labels about everybody and everything. We think we're seeing somebody, but we're not. We think we're talking to somebody. We think we're relating to somebody, but we're not. We're relating to our ideas about them, our projections, our fixations. Is that clear? He says, by purifying externally perceived objects, means purifying them of all of that, all that mental fabrication, your perceptions are freed in themselves. By purifying the perceiving mind within, your non-clinging awareness is freed in itself. What do we have to purify within? What? This idea of self. Right? Because it is the idea of a self, the identification with a self, that then reaches out into the world and clings and attaches and pushes away. Right? That is not coming from the outside world. That is coming from our own minds. So by purifying the perceiving mind, purifying it of its duality, of its I-ness, the me-ness, the sense of something permanent and stable and self-existence in here, our awareness is now freed. And the lucid wakefulness between is delightful. You recognize your own nature. Why is it delightful? Because now we are free to see things as they really are and to relate to everything without any separation. The flower, the so-called person perceiving the flower, are not different. There's no separation. There's just awareness. And he says that awareness is delightful. Your own unconditioned nature is revealed. Three. So now he will comment on what he said. I guess I really didn't need to. Forgive me for muddying the waters. So he says to the old lady, please listen carefully. As if he's talking to you. How are perceived objects outside purified? Like, let's say we want to purify Harry. If there's anybody who needs purification, it's Harry. How do we purify Harry? This present awareness, the awakened state of mind, is unspoiled by thought and perceives as natural brightness. That means we are simply aware of that. We don't label it anything. We don't call it anything. We have no idea about it. We have no reference point at all. We just see it as it is, just in awareness. In that moment, Harry has been purified. How does it feel? Good, good. The present awareness, the awakened state of mind, is unspoiled by thought and perceives as a natural brightness. This awareness of ours has a natural luminosity in and of itself. Everything is seen clearly. It lights up objects. There is a natural brightness to everything. And then he says, let it be like that, and objects are perceived without being clung to. How many of us go through life totally present to whatever we're perceiving without any thoughts, without clinging? Clinging means what? What? The attachment. But what does that actually mean? What?
Wanting,
needing. But it's really in any way wanting to manipulate that object to make it different. Right? Learning just to let things be and see things just as they are. Not as we want them to be. Not as we need them to be. Not as we'd like them to be. Not as we hope they'd be. Not that we're afraid that they won't be. Not that we're angry because they are a certain way. Fearful they'll become another way. Disappointed that they didn't turn out the way. All of that is because we are clinging to experience. That is the attachment. It is the grabbing on to experience. Very hard for us. In this way, no matter how appearances appear, they are in fact not real and not held to be actual things. Now again, what does that mean? For example, these words that I am speaking to you, right? That you are listening to quite intently, right? And in the moment when they are spoken and you hear them being spoken, they seem quite real, don't they? And yet every word I have spoken today is gone. Where is it? Where are all those words? Even the word I've said a minute ago is gone. So, as I speak the words, they appear real, don't they? And yet, we understand that there's no permanence in them at all. They disappear. That which I looked at a minute ago, I turn now. It appears to be the same, but yet we know it is not. Because he also is in a process of changing. He may be feeling differently now. His body and all that's going on is also changing. So even in moment to moment, things that we think are solid and real are not. Everything is changing. Somebody does something and immediately we like it or don't like it and we form an opinion about that. But that incident that happened is already gone. It's already gone. But we cling to it. And we cling to it with either happiness, oh, that was wonderful, or cling to it in anger, resentment, or disappointment. We cling to it in all kinds of ways. But it's gone, isn't it? And any idea we form about that person is incorrect. Why is it incorrect? Because people are not ideas. And words are one-dimensional. And human beings are very complex. Right. We say, oh, they're not very nice. But what does that mean? Does that mean from the moment they wake up in the morning to the time they go to bed, they're never nice? Oh, that person is so selfish. Does that mean, you know, it's we think this way. We project. And anything we project is incorrect. Because it's one-dimensional. And it's a fabrication of our minds. So everything has an appearance. Everything has a temporary existence. But nothing is real. When Buddhism says, people go, wow, that doesn't make sense. I mean, the flower's there. Isn't that real? Yeah, it's real, but it's not real in any permanent way. In any self-existent way. Like again, we call this a flower, but that's just a word. And we know there's no such thing as a flower. Because if I... again, took all the petals off and laid them on the ground, nobody would come in and say, look at that beautiful flower. I could demonstrate to you, but... can you just do it in your imagination? So here is this thing we call a flower, this beautiful flower. But if I, in 10 seconds, I could just shred it and lay it on the ground. Where'd the flower go? See, the only reason it disappeared because there never was a flower in any real, permanent way. It was just a temporary this that we call a flower, but Ista calls a... Yeah, which I can't even pronounce. And we think our words are the thing. Let it be like that. And objects are perceived without being clung to. How are you doing so far today? It's 11:45. We got up at 6. Have you clung to anything today? Any experience? We just do it. I mean, I'm about to say unconsciously. We can't even be up for 5 minutes without doing something. So hard just to just go through our day, being fully present, awake, responding to things as they are, without needing to form opinions, judgments, evaluations, liking, dislike, wanting, not wanting. I mean, and this is not only to the external world, right? We do it with ourselves. I mean, how many people have already clung to their own experiences? Gee, I'm having a great meditation. I hope it lasts. I'm having a terrible meditation. I hope it changes. You know, I'm a great meditator. I'm a terrible meditator. This is a great retreat. This is a terrible retreat. I mean, you know, food's good. Food's terrible. Right? Endless. All because why? Because we just don't let things be. Right? The food is the food. You either eat or you don't. What's the big deal? Huh? Yeah. had a good night's sleep, you had a bad night's sleep. You know, that's all. You can have a bad night's sleep and have a great day. You can have a good night's sleep and have a terrible day. Then what? So what does that tell you? We don't know anything, do we? We think we do. In this way, no matter how appearances appear, they are, in fact, not real and not held to be actual things. Now, I'm sure there could be people already thinking, but look, in my work, I got to do this, and don't I need to make judges? You know, I hear you out there. Just let it be for a while. When we get to the end of retreat, we will deal with how we take this into the world. You know, first, let's take care of step one. Let's get this, and then we can talk about application. See, already we always short-circuit ourselves. We haven't even mastered the basics, and already we're concerned about how to apply it. Right? It's like working with your music teacher. Right? You just learn the basics. You know, then we'll, if you learn the basics, then I'll show you how to actually play music. Right? But if you don't master the basics, if you don't master the finger work and the scales, well, what's the use of showing you a piece of sheet music, right? So it's like that. This is the basics. Okay? We're on retreat. There's nothing to think about. Is there? I mean, there are a few people here who have administrative things, and that's just simple. But for most of us, all we got to do is what? The bell rings, we wake up. The bell rings, we sit down. The bell rings, we stand up. The bell rings, we go eat. It's right. That's all. Am I missing something? See how simple it is. We can just walk around and enjoy ourselves. Think back. It is now 10 of 12. Of all your thoughts today, and all your judgments, and all your grabbing onto this and clinging to that, and thoughts about yourself, thoughts about others, thoughts about this, thoughts about that. If you add them all up, what do they add up to? Any of them, you look back and say, "Really, that was wonderful." You can't even remember them. But at the time, they were so important. Right? Let it be like that. And objects are perceived without being clung to. In this way, no matter how appearances appear, they are in fact not real and are not held to be actual things. Again, this is very important because people go, well, that's it. Actual things in the way I'm saying, that they are permanent, that they are a permanent object unto itself. They're not. Things are just made up of other things, and of course, causes and conditions, they come into being, and they change, and they modify, and eventually become something else. That's just the way everything is. Right? Anybody disagree with that? Yeah, we all understand. Thus, no matter what you perceive, be it the earth or rocks, mountains or cliffs, plants or trees, houses or castles, goods or utensils, friends or foes, family members or companions, husband or wife, sons or daughters, toward all these and all other things, you are uninvolved in the attitude of claiming ownership. Is that clear? He doesn't say you're uninvolved in relationship. For all of you who go, oh, I can just hear you back there, what? Again, even when we read the Dharma, we put our own stuff on it. We claim ownership. my son, my daughter, my husband, my wife, my friend, my partner, my this, my that. We own people, we own experiences, right? We own the weather, we own our bodies. Right, now look at Carol back there, right? She goes around thinking, my body, right? She talks about my body, Carol's body. But there you are, right? Do you have control over your body? What? No, it does whatever it wants. Now it wants to be filled with mucus. Right? And there you go, you know, you've been going around claiming this is my body, and yet it does. And it just does whatever it wants. Right, Sandy? Right? Your body just does what it wants. We call it my body, and yet the truth is, it's not our body. We have a relationship to it. Mm-hmm. It's important. This is the middle way. It's not like we don't have a relationship to it. Right? We have a relationship to it. Right? Carol has a relationship to her body. She blows her nose. Right? She may do something to take care of it, right? But the fundamental fact is the body that is sick. It has a life of its own. Claiming ownership. So we are such imperialists. We are such colonialists, right? We not only claim our own body, but we go around claiming everybody else's. Right? We even claim the world, right? How come the world is the way it is? It shouldn't be that way, should it? Isn't that we all agree? Yeah, the world should be different. I mean, talk about grandiosity. Why is the world the way it is? Because it's in conditions. Because we are just one of 6 or 7 billion. The world is a creation of many, many, many variables. The world is what it is. Doesn't mean one can't work to benefit, to heal, transform. But there's no reason spending time being frustrated, angry, disappointed, sad, scared. It just is the way it is. Why? Because of causes and conditions. If you look into history, you look into sociology, you'll understand the causes and conditions, right? It's economics, I mean. You know, but the bottom line is what? It's the mind of beings that creates their world. Beings who understand their own mind. Beings who understand that the purpose of life is to generate understanding and compassion. People who understand their own mind and understand they are not separate from anything. All the negative stuff that people are doing will just stop when the mind is transformed. If the mind is not transformed, no matter how much legislation, United Nations, truces, treaties, peace, this, it'll never work, will it? It hasn't worked. Why not? Because the real problem has not been dealt with. What's the real problem? The mind. People's ignorance of the way things really are. Because they're ignorant of the way things are, they project out into the world. So, if there's one thing we need to do is what? Give up our imperialistic, colonialist behaviors. As Carol has reminded us, We can't even claim ownership of our bodies. Now, there may be some people who claim, you know, we talk about my body, but we also talk about what? My mind. Right? Isn't that the way we talk? But hopefully in your meditation and your guided meditations, what are you learning about your mind? Can you find it? Does it exist? Is it a thing, an entity with a top and a bottom and a back and a fourth? With an up and a down, with a color, with a shape? When you look for your mind, what do you find? Has anybody looked? What do you find? Nothing. Unbelievable. 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 I can't even claim ownership of my mind. Right? I mean, do you choose your thoughts? You've been sitting in meditation now for 3 days. Do you own your thoughts? They come up in a very sequential order, just the way you've set it up, like a little playlist at the beginning of the day. Is that the way it's unfolded? No. You don't even know what thought's going to pop into your mind next, do you? No, not a clue. And yet we go talking about what? My mind. So, this is very wonderful. You are uninvolved in the attitude of claiming ownership. Please, for the rest of this retreat, give up claiming ownership. If you give up claiming ownership of everything, then how would things be? How would things be? I think Robbie's your...
Free.
Free. Why? Because you'd be free of what? Just give me the short list.
Free of how it should be, free of how it shouldn't be, free of how I want it to be, free of how...
Yes.
Free of what I'm going to do next, free of what I...
Right. And, all right, enough. We get it. And the bottom line is what? Robbie's very busy. Can you see how busy you are? Once you've claimed ownership of everything that goes on, you have to then, you're very busy taking care of everything, making sure it unfolds just the way you want. So not only are we claiming ownership of everything, but why, you know, like they say with home ownership, ownership means responsibility, right? That's part of adulthood. Right? Ownership means responsibility. We teach our children that. Right? So we're busy. Very, very busy. Taking care of all our possessions. Right? All the things that really aren't ours and that we can't control. We're very busy what? Working very hard trying to control everything. Right, Andrew? And then you come to retreat and you're exhausted for the first day. You're like, why? Well, because ownership demands responsibility, and I'm very responsibility, and I just, from the moment I get up to the time I go to bed, I just work at it. Yeah. And we wonder why we're stressed. We wonder why we're tired. We wonder why we're emotionally spent. Can you see? We are claiming ownership of things that we have no business claiming ownership of. I'll just read it again. Thus, no matter what you perceive, be it the earth or rocks, mountains or cliffs, plants or trees, houses or castles, goods or utensils, friends or foes, family members or companions, husband or wife, sons and daughter, toward all these and all other things, you are uninvolved in the attitude of claiming ownership. meditative experiences, good ones or bad ones. Do you own them? No, they're gone. And yet we mull over them, we ruminate on them, try to bring them back, right? Again, it's all the same thing. You're involved in the attitude of claiming ownership, and so they are perceived but not held to be that way. So we are aware. We are aware of the perceived objects. We are aware. Awareness travels through various doors or gates, right? Awareness travels out through the eyes, and we see. Awareness travels out through the ears, and we hear. Awareness travels out through the nose, and we smell. Awareness travels out through the mouth, and we taste. Awareness travels into the body, and we feel sensations. Awareness of the mind, and we have feelings and emotions and thoughts. They're all just arising in awareness, aren't they? Endlessly, endlessly flowing. Right? Does awareness stop? No. But we stop because we fixate. We claim ownership. And all of a sudden everything stops. And we don't even see what's going on in front of us anymore because we are involved in taking responsibility for something in our own minds. So they are perceived but not held to be that way, which means the way of ownership. By being free of clinging to anything whatsoever, you are purified of objects perceived externally. So you remember there are three points. This was the first one. The first point was by purifying external perceived objects, your perceptions are freed in themselves. Right? If you are no longer claiming ownership, if you're no longer grasping, if you're no longer seeing things as permanent entities that need to be grasped, if you no longer are doing that, then you are naturally freeing. As he says here, you are purified. These objects, and they are now free. Your perceptions are free. What does that mean when your perceptions are free? It's a wonderful thing. What? Yeah, well, free from having to do anything, right? See, we always think we have to do something, don't we? We are free of having to do anything, other than what? To be present. And the interesting thing is when we are truly present, we will respond. And that response will come from a deeper place. A truer place than comes from our mental fabrications. So it's not as if we're inert, but our response to life is much more spontaneous, much more natural. Remember the title of this retreat is what? Anybody remember? The natural mind. This is what we're doing. This is what's being talked about. This is not the mind of fabrication. The mind of thoughts and perceptions and issues and projections and needs and wants and fears and hopes. Right? You know that mind. This is not that mind. That mind is not natural and that mind is not spontaneous. We want to free this mind, this true mind, which is right here, right? Like, do you notice you are listening to me? Is everybody listening to me? Yeah. Do you notice that this capacity you have to listen and even to understand is effortless? You don't have to do anything, do you? You just have to what?
Listen.
Yeah, just have to be attentive, just have to listen, be mindful, be present. Yeah, that's all. It's easy. Right? You could even do it laying down. You could do it standing on your head. Right? Sit out on the porch in a rocker. It's effortless. You don't have to know anything about Buddhism. You don't have to know anything, do you? You just listen. And a part of you just understands, doesn't it? We may start thinking about it, and then, of course, we won't understand anymore. But in this moment, we understand, don't we? Oh, yeah. Any questions about this teaching? I think we'll stop here before we go on to the other two. Again, remember I said in the beginning, these are pith teachings, which means very short, right? And yet, they go right to the heart of things. This is the great compassion of Padmasambhava, right? This old feeble lady near death. He knew she was very devoted to the Dharma and very devoted to him, right? She had sent him food every day. And she had, he was a great master, right? He just brought Buddhism to Tibet. He just subdued and pacified all the malevolent spirits of Tibet. And yet, with his entourage on his way to the retreat place at Chimpu, she stopped him and she circumambulated him from her heart, asked him this for teachings that would liberate her. And so he gives her these very wonderful teachings, very profound and yet very simple, right? Many of us who are listening can identify with being feeble-minded, of low intelligence. And yet, even those of us can somehow make sense of it, right? Is there anybody that it doesn't make sense to? Is there anybody who is not clear how to practice it? I know Ken, when he guides the meditation today, will help us do that. Again, you know, there is no more pertinent in meditation instruction than watch your mind. Just watch your mind. Don't watch anybody else's. Just watch your mind, even when you're, you know, out in the woods or walking along the path. Just watch that mind. When you see it claim ownership, as it will do, every time it has an opinion, a judgment, it is claiming ownership of that situation. Just what? Just see it. Smile to yourself. Silly mind. Then relax. Come back. Come back to your body, come back to the breath, come back to whatever you're doing. Just watch your mind. The watchword for today is claiming ownership. Really claim ownership of anything. Yes. You are a sharp one. As it is said in the, she asks, can we claim ownership of our actions? In a certain way, no and yes, right? In a certain way, I would say even our actions are arising because of causes and conditions. Right? But yet, they are our actions. And so we will, because we inherit the effects of our actions, right? We have to have a very personal relationship with our actions. So the way we are acting, thinking, talking, acting with our body, now is the result of past causes. That's what we are, the way we are. And yet, there is another part, because there is self-awareness, because there has been, because I'm a student of Dharma, and because I practice mindfulness, as opposed to when we were deluded, couldn't see clearly, we could not see how what was arising now in my body, speech, and mind was the result of causes and conditions from the past, and so therefore that is what's propelling. But I, this I that is aware, can see that. Right? Causes and conditions may have led me to cross into the street, right? But as I turn my head and I see the bus coming at me, I have the possibility of doing what? Getting out of the way. If my eyes were closed, I couldn't do that, could I? So, you know, it's a yes, like everything else, it's yes and no. Yeah. So, if there's anything that we want to claim ownership of, is my responsibility to my unfolding karma of body, speech, and mind. Because that is the basis also of my future. But again, it's an ownership. You know, it's like if you own a house, right? What do? What? Repair, dig, you're responsible for it, right? But then what happens when you sell that house? Couldn't care less. Never give it a thought. Is it clean? Is it dirty? Is anybody taking care of the repairs? Not a thought. Actually, if you hear something happens to it, you're happy. Thank God I don't have to deal with that anymore. Yeah. So it's interesting how sense of ownership changes things. Right. So while we are temporarily dwelling within the house, we want to take care of it. Because we know that, you know, we or others may bear the responsibility or the effects from the leaky roof, et cetera, et cetera. But on the other hand, we understand that it's just a house. Just temporarily my responsibility. Future might be somebody else's. And so we're not as tight. We're not so attached. So we want to purify objects from the tyranny of our perceptions, our judgments, our evaluations, which are just another way of saying that we claim ownership. Okay? So practice that. And you will watch your mind and you will see it occurring all the time. And then when you have time in meditation or solitary practice, you can begin to look for the source of that which is attaching. What is that that claims ownership of everything? That's another one of those good questions.